television nerds. My name is Anthony Marco, and welcome to TV ABCs, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, Freddie Wanick. Freddie Wanick played Dan in the Gemini Award-nominated CTV original series Dan for Mayor. He was known to television audiences as Hank Yarbo for a six-season run on the CTV hit series Corner Gas. His other series credits include CTV comedy-drama series Robson Arms for three seasons and guest starring roles in Da Vinci's Inquest and Dark Angel. Iwanek's feature work includes a lead role in Young Triffy for writer-director Mary Walsh, plus Black Eyed Dog for Quebec filmmaker Pierre Gang. He had additional supporting roles in New Line Cinema's Just Friends with Ryan Reynolds and the Miramax family film Chestnut. He was the lead in the indie feature The Delicate Art of Parking, premiering at the Montreal World Film Festival, where it won Best Canadian Feature. He made his film debut in MGM UA's A Guy Thing, followed by a role in Santa Claus 2, and just wrapped on his latest feature, Patterson's Wager. And now my conversation with Freddie Wanick. So over the past, let's say, it looks like a year to a year and a half, there's this film. First of all, you've entered into what seems to be like a fantasy science fiction territory, and I haven't seen the film yet, but I read the premise of this film, Patterson's Wager. It looks pretty cool to me.
Yeah, no, it is really cool. It's it's this film that Corbin, the director, made, and he'd literally been saving up money. He made it for $40,000.
Wow.
Yeah, and he did an amazing job. His DOP and camera op guy were the guys that came second in the big Doritos ad for the Super Bowl. Do you remember that? The Flying Pig?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they did that, obviously, before. And it's just a really nice tale. It's really a story about a relationship, this fella going through, they're at a stage in their relationship, and he's wondering whether to move forward, should he move forward, all that. And intermingled amongst it is this, he's got, out of nowhere, he has this ability to see like a couple minutes into the future, which is the most useless superpower to have. But, so he's dealing with that. But the true story is it's really a relationship story.
Well, yeah, I watched the kind of 2 minute or so long trailer for it.
It's really indie feeling, isn't it?
Yeah.
I really like the trailer, and it does justice the movie. It's not one of those things where you see the trailer and go, well, this is nothing like the trailer. The movie has the same tone, really low key, which I really like. The performances are grounded and subtle and real, which I really take to.
Yeah, because when I read the premise and I thought, okay, and I watched the trailer, you're right. Right off the bat, it was this very indie feel, and it could have went the other way. It could have been like this, you know, in a world where a man sees into the future.
Oh, that's a good voice. You could be the new guy. Can I try? Because I got the new mic.
Yes.
In a world. No, it sounds like Yoda. In a world. In a world.
We're 2 minutes into the future, you
can
see.
Oh, you beat me there, too. You got to show me up with the Yoda, too. Oh, you're... Ugh.
But very cool concept, and I like it. I'm going to have to go seek it out now. I know that it looks like it's... I went onto the Facebook page and saw that it's going to some film festival in Hawaii or something like that.
No, and my wife is killing me that we can't go. She's like been at me for ages to go somewhere. Let's just go anywhere, just somewhere she can snorkel. That's all she wants. And I haven't been able to, but, it's had a tough time. I was really surprised. I'm not surprised it didn't get into Toronto. I was sort of surprised it didn't get into Vancouver. I was really surprised it didn't get into Whistler, because I really think it's a Whistler Film Fest type of movie. Mm-hmm. And if I don't want to give anything away, but if anybody sees it, they'll understand what I mean by that. It's a real mountain movie. But
there's a lot of really expensive real estate in this film. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, but it's had a tough time getting into festivals, and I've talked to Corbin, the director. We talked a lot about it, and I think it's because it's a nice movie. It's not going to upset anybody. It's not controversial. It's not going to blow you away with special effects or a unique any this or that. It's just a solid bit of storytelling. And when you leave the movie, there's a lot of things you're kind of like, where are they going with this? And when you get to the movie, it wraps up, and you just walk out of there with a really good feeling. And it's weird to say, but people don't seem to want nice films. Does that make sense?
Well, no. I don't know if this is it or not, but when you read the premise of it, and maybe that was a bit of the confusion, is that, like I said, what I expected it to be, I expected that the tone was going to be a bit, like, I was pleasantly surprised that it looked very indie, but I almost expected it to be different because it has that kind of fantasy sci-fi element to it.
Yeah, you're right. And it could be that, who knows, but I hope it gets an audience because it's a film I'm proud of.
It's kind of like an indie romance version of The Dead Zone.
Yeah, like a Canadian version of it where, like, look, guys, we can't go, we don't have the budget to do the full-on Dead Zone. How about it's just 2 minutes? Can you just see 2 minutes into the future but can't do anything about it? Oh, yeah, okay. I always joke that I want to do a Canadian indie heist movie where you never see the heist, you just see them talking about it.
Yeah, exactly. Planning the heist. Yeah,
planning and then come back. Oh man, that didn't go anyway the way we wanted it to.
All in the same room.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got a card table, you got a dartboard on the wall.
Oh yeah, if we could afford it, it might just have to be whatever I got in my house.
Like a Rush poster hanging up there.
Oh, absolutely, a Rush, yeah.
It wouldn't even be in a warehouse. It'd be in someone's basement.
Yeah, we might not even be able to afford Rush. I don't know.
I think we can get this greenlit, actually.
Well, hey, whatever you can do, I'm free.
So how did you get involved in this project?
Well, Alex Zahar was a buddy of the director, and he just contacted me out of the blue, and I met with Corbin, and I'd read the script, and I really took to the script. And then when I talked to Corbin and he just talked about the tone, he talked a lot about films, you know, like anything the Duplass brothers would do pretty much.
Right.
And that's what I saw when I read it. And so I was in, and even when I heard the budget and basically I'd be working for free pretty much. I wanted to do it. It was a project that I really wanted to do.
Really tight shooting schedule, I imagine.
You know, it wasn't that bad. I think it was 16 days, which isn't ridiculous for an indie film anyway. Yeah. So, and he didn't have to do any reshoots. He really did his homework and made sure he was prepared for every shoot day. And just a lot of things just came together for it. And a lot of people did, like I said, worked on it for free. And it was just one of those projects. It was just a lot of fun and it was really rewarding.
Very, very cool. So I'm looking forward to seeing it. It is one of those things where I saw the little 2 minute trailer and I thought, like I say, I was so captured by the fact that the tone was completely different than I expected. And I went, now it's something I want to see.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, I hope you do get to see it. I hope you like it. It's, I think if you like the trailer, I'm sure you'll like the film. Yeah.
Yeah. It was very cool. Now it seems like this is a little bit different than the characters we're used to seeing you play on television though.
Yes.
And that, I have to imagine that's what attracted you to it to a certain degree.
Yes and no. I mean, it wasn't a thing like I was searching for something to prove I can be different than anything I've done before. I mean, it wasn't anything like that. It was just
good,
you know,
good script, good character.
Yeah. And to be honest, I can only choose the projects that are presented to me. So, sure. You know, a lot of the times I'm not presented with projects that are much different than what you see me do. So, but yeah, no, it was both those things, really. Okay. Something I wanted to do, and just as a bonus, it was a character just slightly different than what I'm normal to.
Very cool. Where did you start? Where did the acting bug first catch you? Was it as far back as school?
Well, yeah, but not because I wanted to be an actor. I think, and I shouldn't say acting, I was always kind of a class clown when I was growing up, and that was sort of, that was my survival mechanism, especially in, I was always a little kid.
Right.
So it was either get beat up or be funny. So I was funny, I guess.
And you caught the infectious nature of the laugh.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know. It was I don't know where it was. I mean, I took theater in high school, but I always found a way to get out of the school productions because I was scared. To get on stage. I had a bunch of anxiety about it.
Okay.
And but then when high school came to an end, my folks said I had to go to school. I had to go to college, and I didn't know what to take, and I don't know why. I said, "Oh, I'll try out for the theater program," and I got in, and I got asked to leave, and then and then through that, because I had theater on my resume. I got a job at the Science Center here in Vancouver doing kids shows, paleontology shows right. and stuff. So I knew nothing about acting and nothing about science. And I was doing all these shows at the Science Center. But through that, one of the guys I was doing shows with was taking an acting class. He said, oh, man, you should come out and check out this class. And I did. And that was a woman by the name of Shay Hampton. And something about it stuck. I really enjoyed her approach. And through that, I, you know, ended up getting an agent that came in and checked, saw me and said, hey, you know, you want an agent? And just started kind of pecking away and getting work here and there.
That's kind of a cool way to almost back into it, though. It's almost like you were inexorably going to be drawn to this no matter what you did. It's like,
through
your best efforts trying to not do this, you ended up doing this.
That's right. I mean, I thought I was going to be a truck driver. My grandpa had a trucking company. I thought, oh, cool, I'm going to be a truck driver. That's awesome. Actually, at one point, when my mom asked me what I wanted to be, I think I was 7 or 8, maybe even older than that. I thought I'd be a police dog. I thought that was feasible. But that's all true. It's one of my earliest memories. I can remember my mom. I was in the back seat of, she had this gold Volkswagen Bug. And she said, what do you want to be when you grow up, Freddie? I said, I want to be a police dog.
That sounds like a 70s Disney film in the making. It's like the Shaggy DA, right? It's
like... You and I, we've got two, just like that. What have we been talking? 5 minutes and we got like two projects already on the go?
It's like the Shaggy D.A. or the Incredible Mr. Limpet with Don Knotts. It's like,
oh, man.
All of a sudden, you go through some magical something at a precinct and you become the dog.
Oh, man, we're on to something.
There you go. It's perfect. It's amazing how did that follow up with just, slowly getting part by part by part and building yourself up that way? Or was there kind of... You know, did you hit a point where you said, okay, now this makes sense to me. I've got to make a push to do this.
Yes and no, actually. I never really thought, even when I got my agent and I was getting like literally little bit parts here and there, I didn't really think it was going to be a career. I had very little confidence in anything I did when I was, I still don't. I just had very little confidence in myself. Okay. But something about like, my confidence grew, and when I was turning 30, I decided, not because I thought I could actually do it, but just because it was the only thing going for me, I was like, okay, I gotta just go all out with something in my life. I gotta make a go of something. I can't just be floating around.
Right.
I don't want to be 40 floating around, and here I am 40 floating around. But so I just... I made a commitment. I was like, okay, I'm gonna commit to this. And I started taking, my acting classes more seriously. And, acting became the thing. And it was the most important thing for a while. And that is when things really started to get going. And within that year, I got Corner Gas and other movie parts that, really made it clear that, okay, this is my career. This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. I always enjoyed it, but I was always scared,
Right.
And now I'm, I really want to be on set. I really want to be part of productions, and it's fun for me. It's not a anxiety thing anymore.
Where do you think that fear came from? Was it the traditional, which I think we all feel at some point, a fear of failure, or was it something else in maybe... insecurity that, you're necessarily when you're on a set, you're around a bunch of people. I think that it still happens to me. When you walk into a room, you instantly think everybody's better at something than you are.
Oh yeah, that's exactly it. No, that is exactly it. I've always been insecure. I always was the kid that didn't think I could do it. I always saw the danger and everything. I was that shaky little kid in the corner that didn't want to jump in the pool or didn't want to show my legs. If I did go swimming, I'd wear a t-shirt because I thought I looked like an idiot and I didn't want anyone to see me with my shirt off.
Right.
All that stuff, all that insecurity stuff. It's all that. Absolutely.
It looks like, and I'm going right back to the beginning here, between, some of your earliest roles for about 5 years, you just a lot of television and film roles, like small parts. I mean, going back as far as the new Addams Family.
Yeah, that was my first television gig, actually. I was a spinning gnome.
Now that was, it's funny, one of the other podcasts I do is a retro television podcast, and we just talked about the original Addams Family recently. And we mentioned the new Addams Family because it was one of those things where That just seemed to be that was just a series that still lives on today for some people.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And it's just crazy. I mean, it's still shown on some television shows, but or on still some television stations. But quite a bunch of stuff, like Chris Isaac Show, Cold Squad, Dark Angel. I remember that show because I'm fantasy.
I play two different guys on that show. Yeah, I got yelled at by, I'm blanking. Big producer guy, director guy, Titanic.
Oh, James Cameron.
James Cameron. Yeah, I got yelled at by James Cameron
really?
On that set. Yeah, it was awesome. Yeah.
Like he was mad at you?
Well, no, I think I was just in the line of fire, and like it was this big old scene that wasn't working out, and he needed somebody to push a flag up or something, and somebody said they got it, but he didn't hear it, and he looked at me, and he's like, he yelled my character name, push the flag up. I'm like, okay, and then there was like five of us pushing this flag up.
Like, really, Unobtainium Man? Really, Mr. Yeah, Avatar?
Now if he hears this, I'll never work for James Cameron ever again.
Unless you're planning on diving for ships, I think you're okay.
Okay, good.
A recurring role on Da Vinci's Inquest.
Oh, which, yeah, that was, I loved working on that show.
Which is like a lot, after a lot of kind of one episode parts, that's kind of, it seems to be where the Canadian tie comes back in, because a lot of those other shows were, now some of them were probably shot in Vancouver, I'm guessing.
Oh, they all were. All that stuff you're seeing was shot in Vancouver.
All Vancouver shot?
Yeah.
So you never did the LA thing?
No, I did. I went down for 1 year, actually, after Dan for Mayor. I went down to just to feel it out, I guess. And but before that, no, I never. Same thing, fear.
Yeah.
And also, I had friends that had gone down there, friends that had built up a lot of work locally, and then they'd gone down and had come back, and with a lot less money in their pocket, and pretty much having to start over again in Vancouver, which I didn't really want to do at the time.
You had a certain level of comfort, in whether it's in Vancouver or Toronto or in Canada in general, and you head down to LA and it's like, wow.
Yeah.
There's like, but, now there's like 10,000 people who are like, who've done the same level of work as me, and it's like, holy crap.
Yeah. But, the risk reward is a lot higher down there. So,
sure.
But, no, I know. And having gone down there later, it's one of those things. I don't regret any of the choices I made, but I see I could have, if I could have just kicked myself in the butt a little, I could have done it.
Now,
I don't know. I don't mean like I could have become a big star. I mean like I could have gone down and tried.
Right. And like you say, so much of any creative endeavor, I mean, for a lot of years, I mean, I grew up as a musician, and the risk reward is what it's really all about, because in as much as you love to think that everything's going to be based on your ability or your talent or your dedication or all of that stuff, ultimately, it's going to come down to timing, luck and timing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I've come to realize is like all I can do is just be prepared for the chances I get and just worry about what I can worry about. The rest of the stuff, there's nothing I can do about it.
Now, from 2004 to 2009, not only Quarter Gas, which I want to talk about, but tying in there also like 19 episodes of Robson Arms as well.
Yeah.
Those are some heavy duty working years for you.
They were. I was going insane.
Yeah.
And I looking back, at the time I really appreciated it and I loved it. And that's when I really started to feel comfortable with work, with getting work and feeling like I belonged and could be an actor. Like those years, there was also a couple TV movies at that time. Like there was a 4-year period where I was going from, flying in from Regina to Vancouver to do Robson Arms, then back to Regina to shoot some stuff, and then to Edmonton to do this. You know what I mean? Like I was jet setting, and I loved it. It was great. And then, of course, that dries up after a while.
Right. But I mean, the nice thing about that though is, I imagine it could have been easy to just settle into that, to settle into the character of Hank on Corner Gas and just say, all right, this is, I'm having fun doing this. This is who I am. But instead, at the same time, over that 5-6 year period, you're playing all these other characters as well.
Yeah, no, it was great. I loved it. Like somebody said it. It's nice to mix it up. And it gave me the confidence that I'm not just this, me a talking face. I can actually play a different character now and then.
And did you find it when you were doing a long running series like that, how jarring was it to go from almost like a family, a community-like atmosphere 1 week to all of a sudden jumping out into, hey, I'm going to be shooting this for now 2 weeks and then jumping back into it? Because you had to, I imagine after a couple of years doing Corner Gas, you had to feel pretty safe with that group of people that you had there.
Oh, it was very comfortable. Robson Arms set was a great set, though, so it was really easy. It was a real family-oriented, family feeling-oriented set. Susan Nielsen and Gary Harvey and everybody, all the upper-ups of that show are really solid, good people, so that trickles down all the way, and it was a comfortable set, so it was really easy.
Right. And then taking off to do some of the TV movies and stuff like that, that would usually probably just be off shooting. I don't know when you would have off shooting season with those other two series. That had to be difficult to figure out.
Yeah, there was one Selling Innocence where I was like basically playing a pedophile sex offender, and that was a bit jarring actually. Now that I really think about it, it's like, what? How come nobody's laughing? Oh, right, that's right. I'm a jerk.
It's like, oh, we didn't. Where's the studio audience on this one? Like, I'm not seeing. And Corner Gas. Now, I have to imagine that that's going to be you in some fields, in some places. You're going to be walking down the street, and you're going to be Hank.
Yeah.
For a big chunk of the rest of your life, to a lot of Canadians, you're going to be Hank.
Yeah, that's okay.
Is that okay with you? Have you come to grips with that? That's what it's going to be.
Have I come to grips with? Yeah. Well, I don't. It doesn't bother me. I like it. People are nice. If people were coming up to me, hey, you're Hank, and then punch me in the face, that would be miserable.
Because you hear some actors that really have a problem with the idea of the feeling that they've somehow been typecast as this character, and you know they get turned off. You know, especially after the series is over. But I have to imagine that. I mean, you're doing a show for the purpose of entertaining people and of getting fans. And if that's what they remember you for, that can't be the worst thing in the world.
Yeah. I always thought it was weird when like you hear of a big musician who had a big hit and they never wanted to play that hit cause they were so sick of it. It's like, but that hit made a lot of people happy. You should feel good about that. And I'm proud of Corner Gas. I'm proud that people enjoy it. And I know there's obviously people out there that it's not their thing too, but for the most part, you know, I don't know. That's like you say, it's the whole point. The whole point of it is to entertain people, and you know, you want them to like the stuff you do. And if they do, you can't then turn around and go, well, that's not all I can do. Seems kind of weird to me. I mean, all that typecasting stuff, it goes back, same thing, you know, that's just stuff you can't control. I mean, you take the jobs you're given and they're going to have their life and you don't really have control over that. Right. So you just go with it. And, you know, at any point, if I didn't like it, I could have left. And I liked it. I would have done that character for, you know, as long as they'd let me. It was a great job.
For sure. Did you ever have any urge or did you get the opportunity to expand your role on the show at all?
No.
Okay.
No, it was, I don't want to say a strict show, but, you know, this is the script. And,
right,
you know, Because you
sometimes hear about that with a longer running show, like as people hang around for a while, you say, yeah, maybe I'd like to try and direct an episode or write this episode or do this and this and this.
Yeah, and I think there were times where maybe other people wanted to direct and stuff, but I don't think they wanted to open the door to, you know, you let one person, then everybody's going to want to direct, and I can understand why they wouldn't want that to happen. And at the time, I definitely didn't have any desire to direct, so I was happy just. You know, that's what I was hired for.
Right.
So,
And then pretty much like within a year after Corner Gas goes, which shocks a lot of people, is because, I mean, beloved show.
It shocked us too.
Yeah, I can imagine. Because that's one of those things where we were just talking about every other week we do kind of a news version of the podcast, myself, Greg, and Diane, and we talk about the fact that last week we just talked about the idea that what's that? There's a tipping point with a series when you get past like the third year, it seems like it can go on for like a long period of time. Like if it makes it past that second year into a third year, then it seems like there's enough momentum behind it and inertia behind it that it can, if it really wants to, it can keep going until it burns out, and that can just be through story or whatever it is. But It was a heck of a long run. I mean, when you consider the fact that over the past 20 years, you don't get long runs, especially of sitcoms like that in Canada.
No, I guess you don't. I haven't really thought about it, but I think you're right. I mean, 6 years is a great run, and it was a successful run, and it went out on its own terms. So you can't really argue that, can you?
Yeah, for sure.
But you know, they had us under contract for another 2 years, and I think I speak for the rest of the cast. We sort of assumed that would be the end of the run. We thought we would get the 8 years out, but of course that didn't happen.
Yeah, for sure. But pretty quickly on to Dan Vermeer.
All right.
Now, that I'm guessing you had to almost have that close to being in the works when Corner, like, it seemed to come out fairly quickly after.
Yeah, they Kevin White, who was the showrunner on Corner Gas for that last season, about halfway through season six, approached me and said that they had this in development, and they were thinking about me, and they wanted to put me on tape for network to see if network thought it would be a good idea. And so I kind of had a whiff about it then, and then I didn't hear whether it was going to go. It was a little after we wrapped season six, but pretty close to the end of it. They said they're going to shoot a pilot, so we shot the pilot. And then I think it was about a year before we actually shot the first season.
Okay.
Pretty close to a year anyway.
Now, was that something whereby just coming off of the run of Corner Gas that you had, you'd pretty much gotten past a lot of any of the early concerns that you had in your career? Like, you were saying, you know what, I've got no problem. I'm going to carry this show, and we're going to have a blast with it, kind of thing.
Yeah, before we started taping, we were joking, but I don't think I'm the smartest guy in the world. I didn't think about any of that stuff. I was just stoked somebody wanted to give me a job. You know, and then it wasn't until we started shooting the pilot. I guess actually when we finished the pilot, and I was having a conversation with the guys, and I was like, I'm the lead character. It's like, you know. In a way, I found
my character's right in the title.
Yeah, I know. I never found it stressful because if I was like the creator, producer, and star of the show, I would definitely have felt more stress.
Right.
But I was literally a hired gun. I was coming just to play the character. So, my only stress was, and once I realized and sort of moved into the realm of like lead character and not supplemental character. You know, my job wasn't to be funny. My job was to carry story,
right,
and be basically the eyeballs of the audience, essentially. And once I figured that out, which unfortunately it wasn't until about halfway through second season, it became a lot easier. But I actually really enjoyed that. Not that upset me that Dan Vermeer wasn't as successful as I hoped it would be, because
right.
I really liked when the initial idea of the show and what the first season was trying to do really appealed to me. Like the idea of a funny soap opera was really appealing to me. And I kind of wish somebody championed it and sort of said, no, you guys got to really go for it. You know, really, really go for it. And that's what we want you to do. But I think people got scared, and, you know, when it came out and people realized it wasn't Corner Gas again, they started trying to tinker with it and make it Corner Gas-ish.
Right.
And even though I thought season two was funnier than season one, I still really liked the notion and the idea of season one. And I wished that they went full out and that's what the show was.
Right.
And I wish somebody gave it a shot. Cause I think two or three seasons of really pushing that kind of idea, I think it's something that could have caught on at the time.
Right. What I wondered when the show was on was doing the kind of transition between season one and season two of the characters. I know this sounds silly, but sitcoms almost barely move, most sitcoms, with regards to character development.
Right.
And you had a major shift between season one and season two.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of story anyway. And I'm wondering if that's the problem is I actually want to see stuff like that. Like, it's exciting to me to see characters develop, even though it might be on a show that you consider a comedy. But the traditional sitcom is, I mean, let's face it, you take a look at a show like you know, even Big Bang Theory, those characters have been the same for 7 years.
Right.
They don't change.
Yeah.
And it's a funny show. It's a character-driven show, but nothing changes. And that's been like that hallmark of the teleplay-type comedy for years and years and years. I love it when characters can actually develop and move on like that, but it's hard to drag an audience with it, I think.
It is. I totally understand the fear of a network or, you know, maybe even creators and stuff of, like, you know, not being successful. Like, we all want to be successful, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I'm drawn to that as well. I mean, all the shows that my wife and I watch and really get into, they're all, you know, the characters are going through changes and, you know, it's interesting. Like, that's what hooks you. But I also understand the comfort of an audience. Sometimes you just want to go and not think and have this world that never changes. It's nice to think that there's a like, you know, when you go home to have dinner with mom and dad, you want everything to be like it was.
Yes.
You know, you want some place to go. And I think that's what these shows are. Like Corner Gas was definitely that for a lot of people. It was just a comfort. It was home and nothing changed. And that's what they wanted. And that's what was great about that show.
Now, you did shoot some of that show in my hometown of Hamilton where I'm sitting right now.
Oh, are you? You're in the Hammer?
I'm in the Hammer.
That's a tough town.
Oh, I know.
I mean, like, there were times I was walking back, you know, to the hotel and I was like, I could get stabbed. I could just, like, somebody could randomly run up to me and go, hey, I like your show. Stab! Ah! Why did you do that? Welcome to the Hammer. You know, like, but the people there are like, wicked real.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, there's no BS there.
Yep. No, that's for sure. I mean, I'm born and raised here, and I absolutely love this city. I mean, you did a lot of shooting around the area, too, like Kitchener and Waterloo, but I noticed that that some of the shots were in Hamilton as well, and that whenever I see shots in Hamilton, I can almost notice Hamilton shots on shows without even knowing it's Hamilton. Like, not even seeing landmarks, just the way the streets are, the way the houses are, it's just like, that looks like Hamilton to me.
Yeah, right. I'm kind of the same way now when I watch stuff. And I won't even see a landmark, but there's just something about the way it's shot, the landscape in the back. Oh, that's Vancouver. You know, you can just pick it out.
Yeah.
But no, it's situated in a beautiful spot too, Hamilton.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, it was, I'm not going to lie though. I got scared sometimes walking around down there.
You should be scared.
Okay, good.
You got to be a little bit scared, right? great cast on Dan Vermeer too. One of my earlier interviews on this, on TV ABCs was with Benjamin Ayers.
Oh yeah. He's a wicked talented dude. Yeah. We did have a great Paul, Lori Murdoch, his character, like there were times on set, like I'd cry, like just, I don't know why, just it's something about his character. And then it was, I don't know, for some reason, I really, I don't know, I felt more comfortable on that set sometimes in Corner Gas. That sounds weird because I was really comfortable in Corner Gas, but I don't know, some days I miss that show more for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah, but I think that kind of makes sense. And I think it also makes sense when you maybe feel... Is it maybe that you're the titular character, so to speak, you know, in Dan Vermeer, that you feel more of an affinity with the cast?
It's hard for me not to giggle when you say titular.
I know. I went there. It's my English major in nature coming out.
Well, you're smart. You know, that word would mean something completely different to me, but I know what you mean.
Well, I am from the Hammer. I mean, it can mean a couple different things, to be honest with you guys. So now also just... skipping over back a few years, this past year, Corner Gas the movie, just to kind of wrap up this kind of big arcing envelope that occurred with it seems like Corner Gas, Robson Arms, and then going into Dan Vermeer, and then this Corner Gas the movie. I was very curious when this came out, because to me, when I saw it coming out, I was kind of like, it's almost like it's almost like when you hear that a movie's going to be remade.
Right.
And you think, do we want it to be remade or do we not want it to be remade?
Right.
And like, so when you first heard about it, I mean, other than the fact that you probably said, hell yeah, I want to see all my friends again. Were there any reservations going into that? Or what did you think, heck yeah, this is something we're all going hardcore into?
Right. No, well, even before I knew, and the movie was a complete surprise to me. Like when we got the call,
yeah.
I was surprised. No, but even before then, there was always talk, or people would ask, is there going to be a movie? Is there going to be a movie? And my thought process too was like, well, what would a corner gas movie be? Like, it didn't really make much sense to me. And I always thought, well, you know, maybe a Christmas special would make sense if we came back and did like a TV movie, sure. Christmas special or something like that. So yeah, I had my reservations for sure. I had no idea what it was going to be. But when Brent called, I was excited, more for the fact that I got to go back to Regina and see a bunch of friends and be with the cast and the crew again. To be completely honest, was more the reason why I was excited. Also because at the time it came good, I needed a paycheck. And if I'm being completely honest.
No, that's fair. I think that's the story of Canadian television and film, no, really.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, as I've learned. And but then, you know, as we got into it and the scripts came out, I started to get more excited about it. And then when I saw the first cut, I thought, no, it makes sense. And Brent always said it was sort of a love letter to the fans, and I think he got it bang on. It really is sort of a big thank you and a love note to the fans of the show, and I think they did a pretty damn good job of it, to be honest.
There's always going to be that interesting. There's always going to be that interesting thing with fans, because when they have a show that didn't quite come to the resolution they wanted, and then you're offering them this new resolution to it.
Yeah.
You can fall on either side, and fans can be fickle, as I'm sure you've found out many times in your career.
Yeah, oh, for sure. But I don't know. Like I said, I think the majority of the fans for sure anyway are pretty happy with the way they did it. And, you know, now it's put to bed and it's done and we can all move on.
For sure. I have to ask, first of all, before we get any further, I think it's time for a beverage update.
Oh yeah,
we haven't had a beverage update. I'll kick things off. I've become on this podcast a legendary bourbon drinker. I love my bourbon, and I collect bourbon. So the bourbon that I'm tasting tonight, quote unquote tasting, is called John E. Fitzgerald's Larceny Bourbon.
Larceny.
Larceny.
Wow.
Is that
because you'll commit larceny after you've had a few, or
after you've had the bottle? I think you will. It's by a distillery called Heaven Hill down in Kentucky.
Oh wow!
I actually visited the distillery last summer. So
nice.
Yes, very. It's called a very special small batch. All I know is I've got one bottle of it. I don't care how much smaller it is. Other than that, it's smaller after this drink. I know that much. So,
wow, you put me to shame. I was having tea. I didn't realize it was this kind of show. I would have grabbed an adult beverage.
But what kind of tea?
It's just like a black. It's an Assam.
There you go.
Yeah,
you can make it sound very fancy. Like it can. You can make it. You know, you can say artisanally drawn from the tea leaves in the.
Right. Okay. I'm partaking in an Assam tea with a splash of rose water and a touch of vanilla.
Oh.
I refer to it as a royal tea.
That's very interesting. Something that they might serve in Victoria at the tea room.
Yes, at the tea room would be nice. Yes, for afternoon tea.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Do you have any cucumber sandwiches with that? I'm just wondering.
Yes, I've got my layered tray of cucumber and egg salad sandwiches with the crust cut off.
Oh, of course.
You know, I actually had tea. I had afternoon high tea. It's called, I guess.
At the Empress, is it?
No, at the was it the Fairmont? Oh, I think it was the Fairmont with Mary Walsh and Stuart McLean.
Wow.
A few years back. And it was the most like surreal, amazing moment. I just sat there and shut up and like nibbled on my sandwiches and drank my tea.
You just close your eyes while you're listening to Stuart McLean.
Oh God, what a voice that guy's got. And Mary Walsh is like the sharpest mind I've ever witnessed. She's incredibly bright. Her and Brent Budd, I've always said, are the smartest, funny people I've ever met in my life.
I think it would be surreal for me being with Stuart McLean, like anywhere outside of listening to him. It's like, I just, you know, imagine him being at a McDonald's or something like that, or at a Tim Hortons.
Oh, yeah. Ordering the Big Mac special or something.
It's like, I'll have the Big Mac special.
You're like the Rich Little of podcasts. You're just blowing me out of the way with these
voices. And Morley over here will have the double cheeseburger.
Oh my God! When he, you know, when it's his time, they could just hide it from the entire nation, and you could just roll in, and nobody would know. It's the beauty of radio.
I'll just get a folk band to play behind me, and we'll be all set.
Yeah.
One of the things that I always ask on the podcast, because I love to hear this from everybody I talk to, is I know that I was so influenced by kind of the pop cultural touchstones when I was growing up, like television, radio, music, all of that stuff. I'm always curious to know television, film, music, what the stuff that you grew up with that you kind of reach back to and has still kind of left this indelible mark on you today. Like for me, it was like 70s Saturday mornings.
Right. Like that was huge for sure for me. Like I used to, Scooby-Doo started right at 3 o'clock.
Right.
I guess that's more 80s. No, that's like the end of the 70s.
Yeah.
So luckily I lived a block from school, so I would literally burn it home so I could catch Scooby-Doo. You know, oddly enough, do you ever remember the animated film The Hobbit?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That was the Rankin and Bass version, I think.
Yes. Yeah. To this day, I carry a digital copy with me wherever I go. It's like my bedtime story.
Wow.
If I can't sleep, I put that on, and it's like since I was a kid. I remember the first time I read it at Moody Elementary, the library there. There was a book, not the Tolkien Hobbit book, but there was somebody did an illustrated version of The Hobbit that I was like, oh, and that brought me into the Tolkien world and the Rask version of The Hobbit.
Right.
And as long as I can remember, The Hobbit's been part of my life.
And it was weird because then Ralph Bakshi did like this crazy surreal version of the Lord of the Rings,
which I've also
got. The first two books. And then there was the Rankin-Bass version of Return of the King.
Yeah. So you can actually connect all three of those together.
You got a bookended with Rankin and Bass, something out of a Christmas specials.
Yeah, there's some inconsistencies, but if you sort of, you know, throw your mind out there, it actually kind of works. It's entertaining anyway.
It's kind of like you drop a couple hits when you're watching The Hobbit, and then by the time you get to Lord of the Rings, it's like
it really kicks in.
Yeah, and then at the end of Lord, you get back to The Hobbit again. It's like, okay, I'm just easing
down
right now.
Yeah, that brings it back. If you want a real, there's one that just, it's, what is The Last Unicorn is another one of those from that. And it's just, it's bizarro.
Yeah. What kind of music growing up?
Oh, growing up? Well, I kind of listened to whatever my mom wanted me to listen to. So Michael Jackson, like I'm talking when I was young.
Yeah.
Michael Jackson. But oddly enough, she got me De La Soul CD. 3 Feet High and Rising, brought me into, which I think probably took me away from, okay, Mom, I don't want to listen to anything else you're telling me to listen to. I'm going to start listening to my own stuff. And so when I was growing up, what was big for me was actually a buddy of mine, Orson, when he drove us around, all you were allowed to listen to were the Ramones. So I got hooked into the Ramones.
Right.
So I listened to a lot of the Ramones, and then the Tragically Hip came along, and I kind of got a hodgepodge. I've always liked Paul Simon and Simon and Garfunkel.
Right. Is that the stuff you still go back to today? Like if you get your playlist going and you open up your whatever device you've got, do you still have that stuff sitting on there?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I still got all that. I got like literally a hodgepodge. Like when I was a kid, I also played hockey and lacrosse. So there'd be like, you know, Metallica and Guns N' Roses and AC/DC. And then there'd be like, you know, Duran Duran and, you know, all that NXS. And, you know, I was like a head case when it came to music. I would listen to anything. Even to this day, really the only stuff that I don't get into would be like the kind of real gangster rap or, like the real popular type of country.
Yeah.
I'm not really into, but like stuff like Dwight Yoakam or going back to like Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
I kind of dig that kind of stuff.
The old school country. And I even like some of the old school, the bluegrass. It's just like, some amazing, amazing stuff.
Yeah. I'm pretty, and a lot of the singer songwriter stuff I love.
Yeah.
Neil Diamond. I'm going to go see Neil Diamond's coming to town. I'm going to go see Neil Diamond. I love Neil Diamond.
My parents were hardcore into Neil Diamond and I had to listen to it so often. And I knew every single song. I could never really get into it myself, but I knew every single song.
My mom played Carly Simon, You're So Vain, over and over and over again. And I think it was like, it was just me and my mom till I was 7. So I think it might have had something to do with relationships.
Whenever you hear that song now, it's like, hang on for a sec. This just seems weird.
Yeah. Earlier in life, whenever I went through a breakup, I would just call her up and whoever the ex was and play her Carly Simon So Vain. I don't know why, but you have to listen to this.
Wouldn't say anything. Just play it.
Yeah.
Listen. So what are we seeing in the future? You were telling me earlier on that a lot of the focus is on film now. Is that just because the opportunities are kind of presenting themselves in film?
Well, to be completely honest, the opportunities haven't been as great as I'd hoped they'd be. Right. And so it's more looking to create my own opportunities. And I've got three feature scripts in development. One further along than the other two. One I co-wrote with a buddy of mine.
Okay.
One looks like it'll shoot this summer. Awesome. And then, I would love to have been able to go back into another series, but I just haven't had the opportunity for that. So,
right.
I spent a year sitting on my butt waiting for somebody to give me a job. And then I decided, well, I should probably just make my own job then if that's going to be the case.
And it's, you know, I hear that, and it's a bit disappointing to me that almost the same thing you're going through after all of the successes that you've had is the same thing that they're telling people who are just coming out of a drama school or a film school right now, is you don't sit back and wait, you just make your own stuff. But it seems to be that that's the nature of the industry up here.
It seems to be. I mean, in Vancouver, I know it's a little, it's a, especially for Canadian content, original content, it's better in Ontario. But here, Vancouver is the majority of its business is service to Hollywood. So yeah. The kind of parts, like if I wanted to literally start over again and go back and be security guard number one or stoner dude in the corner, I probably would get more auditions.
Right.
But I don't know. I just don't have a desire to kind of go backwards. So,
right.
So I kind of figured this might happen. And so I can sit around and whine and complain about it, or I could get off my keister and try to create the stuff that I want to do. And that's what I'm trying to do. And we'll see if it works out that way or not, but it's better than waiting around or begging for somebody to, I don't know. I just feel weird about doing roles that don't excite me anymore.
Yeah.
And maybe that sounds stupid because somebody should say, oh, if you got an opportunity to work, you should just do it. But it's not like people are offering me the work. Like,
sure.
You know, it's like, hey, could you come in and pre-screen for two lines in this thing? It's like, well, pre-screen, what? You know, it's like, if he offered me it, maybe, yeah. You know, yeah, that sounds okay. But it just feels not disrespectful, but kind of like, I don't know. I don't want to play that game. It's like, I don't want to be in my 60s plugging away.
Yeah.
You know, if this is the stage where I'm at now where nobody's, and I don't expect, and I don't think anybody should expect anything to be handed to them. I think you should earn it. But I believe that I've done enough work that, I've earned the opportunity.
Yeah. You've paid your dues and you've got your reels, so to speak.
Yeah. I think so.
Reels six years on this show, 5 years on this show.
I always kind of joke. It'd be funny to see like somebody try to like phone up De Niro and say, yeah, I wonder if you could come in and read for this thing. He's like, read, you know? I understand. Have you got a reel? Yeah. It's called Goodfellas. You know, like, that was a horrible De Niro impersonation. My face looks great. I do a great De Niro face. The voice, not so much.
You do the kind of squint and grimace.
Yeah, that's right. But so I don't know. We'll see. And then, you know, I'll give it a go. And if it's not in the cards, then, you know, there's always other ways to pay the bills.
Are you getting kind of the same level of creative enjoyment out of the writing and creating process as you got out of the acting process?
Yeah. No, anything creative has been, I find... I don't know. I really enjoy it. The problem with writing for me, though, is, but I proved to myself I could do it, which is great. This last one, especially, you know, when somebody throws a deadline in the mix,
right.
That's the scariest thing I've ever done creatively.
Right.
Because like when I'm just writing for myself, it's fun and I can, oh, I'm not going to write today. I'm going to go play a round of golf or I'm going to go do this. But when somebody says, okay, can you do these rewrites and I need them by Friday, you're like, ah, you know, and you're forced to sit down. And when you force yourself to do it, you force yourself to be creative. And I'm surprised that I was able to do it and come up with stuff. You know, and sometimes it's total crap, but you've done it. You know, you've created something, and it's better than not.
Well, the under pressure aspect seems to work for you.
It seems to. Yeah. We'll see. But yeah, I really enjoy it, and I don't know if I have a future in writing. It literally came out of trying to, you know, do something for myself, and I hope it turns into something because I really enjoy it.
Thanks so much to Freddie Wanick for joining me on the podcast this week. You're listening to the TV ABCs podcast. Every 2 weeks, you can listen to the TVA podcast, where myself, Greg, David, and Diane Wild talk about just Canadian television news, whatever's going on. We talk about a calendar of upcoming shows and all of that stuff. But every other week, I get to talk to some great people here on all topics to do with Canadian television, and we hope you dig it. If you do dig it, go to our Patreon page where you can support this podcast. If you're interested, you can always listen to it for free, but if you decide it's worth it to kick in a buck or two here or there, go to patreon.com/TV_EH. You'll find a link to that on the TVA website. Please, you don't have to, I'm just saying. You know, it helps to cover the cost. It keeps the lights on here at TVA headquarters. Do we really have a TVA headquarters? Anyway, you can find all the other podcasts that I do at anthonymarco.com. You can find me on Twitter at Anthony Marco. I would also recommend that in honor of the NHL playoffs, if you go to the TV-EH.com website right now, you can do our ultimate tournament of great Canadian television shows broken down by decade that Greg David is putting together. Go there, check it out, vote on your favorite shows. It should be fun. And that wraps up another episode for this week. And now back to your regularly scheduled programming.